It is a wonder my poor grandma's heart didn't give out sooner, because she always used to say, "Alex, Diane, you are going to be the death of me." When my cousin and I were really small and we would visit her at her apartment, we thought it was great fun to run around the open air, the open breezeway hallways of the apartment complex, hiding here and there and exploring, you know, the whole establishment. But she would warn us. She would say, "Now, you two girls, there are bad men, and they could snatch you into one of those apartment doors just that fast. I do not want you running around this complex. I need to know where you are all the time. If you're going to the swimming pool, you're going to go straight to the pool, and I want you to come straight back. And if you don't do that, the next time you're not going to go to the pool." You probably had grandmas like that. And at the time, I thought she was being a fuss budget and a worry wart and worrying about things that were silly. But now I understand completely. Not so much when I was 7 years old. The summer after I turned 16, I worked as a page for the Louisiana legislature. I served both the House and the Senate chambers. And I was so excited. I thought I had arrived in life. I mean, everybody was dressed up, and the building was absolutely stunning, you know, built of granite, polished marble, and giant brass doors, and glittering chandeliers sparkling everywhere, and these massively, beautifully carved wooden desks, and plush red carpets, and it was just amazing. And I was surrounded by important and influential and intelligent people who were doing important work, or so I thought. I was enamored, I mean enamored by it all at 16. I was thrilled to be a part of the echelons of democracy. You know, I was making my mark on the world, but my grandmother was less impressed, and she worried frantically about me working in that place. And she would fret about my safety and give me lectures about walking from the parking lot all the way up to the front of the building in broad daylight. Something was going to happen to me. And most of all, she worried about the sly foxes that she knew worked in that building. And it was annoying to me, and I would say, "I'm fine, Grandma, I'll be fine." Before my first day of work, she sat me down and she gave me a lesson. She said, "Now, I need you to listen to Grandma. I love you. It's my job to protect you, and I can't do it if you won't listen to me." "Yes, ma'am." "If any of those men make any inappropriate passes at you, you say to them, you call them sir." She said, "Because if you call them sir, it's going to remind them they're old, much too old for you." I said, "Yes, ma'am." "And if they persist, then you say, sir, hell no." Which was very strong language coming from her. And there's probably a good chance I rolled my eyes. "No one's going to bother me, Grandma. Stop worrying." My second day on the job, as I was walking through the chambers in the morning, distributing, they don't have to do this stuff anymore. It's all electronic now. But we used to have to put papers and notebooks, giant notebooks, on these desks. And walking through the chambers, I'm just barely over 16. A man of 50 reaches out and runs his hand up my leg, grabs my leg, and tries to run his hand all the way up under my skirt. I did not tell my grandmother. My third day on the job, a representative in a tailored suit who had to be at least 65 grabbed me and plopped me down on his lap. "Sir, stop that." By the fourth day, I was learning how to stay out of reach. They once invited all the pages to go to a private party, and they said, "Everybody will be there. Everybody's going to be at this party, and you're invited." And I thought, oh, glamorous. It's going to be in a ballroom, right? It's going to look like the inaugural ball in the White House. That's what I convinced myself. And I went home and I told my grandmother, and I was like, "Oh my gosh, Grandma, we got invited to this party." And she was fit to be tied. She said, "You are not going to any party. And why would they invite a child to a party?" She said, "You are not one of them, and they have no business asking you, and you are not going." I wore her down She eventually relented on the condition that my older son, cousin, not son, my older cousin, David, would escort me and remain with me every single second. So he was there to pick me up from the apartment. We're all dressed up. We looked like we were going to the high school prom. And we're going to leave for this party. And she says, "I've been on this earth a lot longer than both of you combined." I bet y'all have used that line before. "And I know a thing or two. And it's my job to protect you. And I can't protect you if you won't listen to me." Oh, Jerusalem. Jerusalem. That city that stones the prophets, how I have longed to gather you like a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. So we drove off and we found the address, and it was not some fashionable place. It was a really sleazy looking motel in a gravel parking lot off of a pitted, poorly paved blacktop road, and our eyes followed the sound, which was pouring out of second-level balconies where all the rooms' doors were open, and our representatives, our senators and representatives, were so drunk they were staggering and in danger of falling over the railing. So we did not get out of the car, and we drove back to my grandmother's apartment, and I told her what I hated to admit. I said, "You were right." And she said, "You're going to be the death of me, Alex Diane." There is nothing worse than seeing somebody you love in danger and not being able to protect them, right? There's nothing worse than that. Parents are hardwired to protect their offspring. You know, from a young age, we're taught never get between a mother animal and her young, but she will tear you apart. God has that same fierce love for us. God has that same fierce, protective love for each and every one of us. And we are God's children, and it's God's job to protect us, but too often, we refuse to listen. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills and stones the prophets, how I have longed to gather you like a mother hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you would not. You were not willing. Like Jerusalem, we want to go our own way and do our own thing, and sometimes we get distracted by the shiny things and the charming and influential people, many of whom haven't got a lick of sense. And we thought we knew what we were doing. We really did. We thought, "We've got this. We can manage our own lives. We don't need God." But the fox is getting closer, and Jesus is worried, not for himself, but for us. We aren't listening. Now, maybe we are here in this room, but the world, not so much. You know, before the 90s, not to talk about the good old days, but they weren't perfect, but before the 90s, most people in the United States participated in some kind of religious institutional life. They just did. It was just something people did. And everyone we knew belonged to a church or a synagogue or something. And they went to worship at least a few times a year. And then things changed. About 35, 40 years ago, we entered a post-religious era. And it started in Europe and the UK, and it made its way over to the USA. And somebody, probably the devil, introduced the thought that religions were the problem with civilization. That religion was the cause of war and all the other injustices of the world. And that what we needed, academic influencers said, was a world without religion. And if we didn't have organized religion, well, then life would be good. And in the news, the focus was never on the good things that people of faith were doing. It always was somehow about the bad, the harm. And people of faith were accused of being anti-scientific and evil and irrational and delusional and just simply weak. Schools and colleges and public debate scrubbed all references to faith from our civic spaces in order to make them more hospitable. And being a person of faith became almost an embarrassment. It really did. So much that everyone, it seemed, was quitting church, and those of us who stuck it out, well, we just stopped talking about our faith in public, and then we stopped talking about our faith in private. And churches kind of slid on teaching people about Jesus and turned into social service organizations. We thought, that's the ticket. Child care services, community centers that are indistinguishable in most ways from all the others around us. And people could comfortably come into the church buildings without having to worship, and they could leave not knowing anything more about the teachings of Jesus, and our messaging was socially correct. Instead of talking about God and Jesus, we spoke about justice and pluralism and individual rights and ending poverty, and we called it gospel, which it is, and it allowed us to fit in a secular, anti-religious world. But today, a majority of people in the U.S. either don't have a sense of God, or they make up their own faith and cobble something together from lots of, you know, ideas and traditions, rituals and thoughts here and there, almost like a magpie decorates its nest with pretty trinkets. But the problem is the world is not a better place without religious teaching and without faith-based communities. As fraught and imperfect as we are, I do think we contributed something. You can't say it's a direct correlation, because yes, there are a lot of other things going on in the world and a lot of other factors, but it does seem interesting that just as religious participation dove off a cliff from like 1990 until now, at the same time, the rates of people feeling disconnected and lonesome and disillusioned and isolated and anger and bitter and anxious and fearful and hopeless, well, that skyrocketed. There are more physical assaults. People just punch each other more often in public than we used to. Suicide is epidemic. People we disagree with become the enemy. Jerusalem, 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 Jesus says, I want to protect you. How I long to gather you like a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you're not willing. But that's changing. More people are looking for religious purpose and meaning with substance, some time-tested truth. I listened to an interesting conversation online, and it's going to be linked in your newsletter this week if you want to listen to it. It lasts over an hour, but it's very good, in which a Roman Catholic guy and a gay agnostic Jewish man, who are both authors and have written on these topics, are talking about faith and religious life, civic life, democracy, you know, the effects on all of this. And what's interesting is they both say more people want to learn about Jesus. Even the agnostic Jewish guy says the teachings of Jesus, you don't have to believe he's divine to follow his teachings. The teachings are good, and we need to be teaching people that stuff. He said, people want to hear about the God who is the source of life and being, who stayed faithful to us even when we turned our backs. We're recognizing that our democracy, our republic, was based on the ethics and insights of Jesus and of the Jewish Ten Commandments and Paul's model for faith-based community life. Things like treating others the way we want to be treated, kindness, gentleness, patience, self-control, mercy, forgiveness, respecting and protecting the property of others, self-respect, supporting one another in our efforts to live a fulfilling life, looking for the good in one another instead of always focusing on looking for the bad, sharing our stuff, working together, concern and consideration to the stranger, the alien, turning the other cheek, listening to one another, acting with love, even towards the enemy, prayer. This is what we need to be talking about publicly. Without it, we're lost. And Jesus laments, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who stones the prophets, how I've longed to gather you like a hen gathers her brood to protect you, but you would not listen. A mother hen spies a fox. Her little chicks are running all around, feeling very comfortable. So the mother hen sits down in one place and clucks out a warning at the top of her lungs. Danger, danger, danger. The chicks are supposed to come. And they take shelter under her wings. And she puts her wings over there, and the little chicks come running, and they dive up under there into that soft down, and they get very still and very quiet. And they stay there until the danger passes. That's how it's supposed to work. Jesus says, "How I long for you to do that. But I'm here, I'm calling you, and you won't come." All it would take for us to survive the attack would be for us to be still and stand close to Jesus under his protecting arm. That's the call of Lent. It's the call to return to the Lord our God. It's to draw near to God's power. It's to listen to Jesus' voice, to learn from his teachings, to accept God's invitation to a banquet with the very bread of life. At his baptism, Jesus' baptism, God said, "This is my son, listen to him." Up on the mount, when he was transfigured in that cloud, God said, "This is my son, listen to him." Jesus says, "My sheep hear my voice and they follow me." And if we won't come and if we refuse to listen, if we think we can do just fine on our own, all by ourselves, that we know best, we don't need God's help, well then, the mother hen will be forced to exercise the only option left. She will draw the predator's attention to herself. She will get up and run around and make a lot of noise and distract that fox to save her chicks, hurling herself into the jaws of death. And that is what Jesus is doing for us. He is heading to Jerusalem. He is drawing attention to himself. He is standing up to the fox and all the powers of the world, and he will die on a Roman cross so that nothing, not even death, can rob us of our life in God. Amen.